Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This month marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and we'll be looking back at that event and what it means today. But first, we want to turn to an environmental concern for the Delmarva Peninsula, sea level rise. Delaware's Sea Level Rise Advisory Committee formally concluded its report, setting out 55 recommendations aimed at helping the first state deal with the ocean levels in the years to come. The report notes that because of low coastal areas and their vulnerability, the state must act now. And among its conclusions is that 8 to 11% of the state's landmass could be inundated by the end of the century, flooding homes, transportation arteries, and industrial facilities. But first, we want to take a look at how home builders are looking at the issue. There have been some sharp critics of the report. The Home Builders Association of Delaware has been one. We talked briefly with Howard Fortunato, its executive vice president, who told us that the sea level rise projections simply went too far.
We certainly recognize, our association and I personally recognize the need for, you know, statewide planning for storm emergencies and science-based sea level rise. But, you know, and we don't dispute that the sea level rise is occurring, Don, but, you know, we just feel like the state is planning for a worst-case scenario, which, frankly, all the experts aren't on the same page.
So what is a worst-case scenario? I mean, what bothers you?
What the worst-case scenario is would be a rise over 100 years of a meter, 1.5 meters. And what we're recommending, and our recommendation is and has always been, what we call, you know, we call an adaptive management, which means plan for a half a meter and keep an eye on it. When I say keep an eye on it, plan on a half a meter now and continue, the state would continue to monitor it as time goes on and react accordingly. I should also say that the current, you know, over the past 100 years, the sea level has risen in the range of about 13 inches. So, you know, we're not just picking a number. We're picking a number that is of a half a meter, which is 50% more than, you know, the historical, and is along the lines of what, you know, some of the other agencies like NOAA and the EPA are using as estimates.
I assume that when you're looking at the estimates for the sea level rise, one looks beyond the past, because there is the assumption that climate change at a very rapid rate, faster than in the past. I mean, how does that figure into the numbers that we're talking about?
Well, the way that fits in is yes, if we were to base it entirely on the past, you know, then the past 100 years it was 13 inches, and you would say, well, geez, then if it's only going to be another 13 inches over the next 100 years. And what we're saying is let's look at an adaptive management and beef that up by 50% to a meter and a, or excuse me, to a half a meter, and monitor it over the next 10 or 15 years, and if necessary, make adjustments.
So what does that mean in terms of what the state and local officials would have to do, I mean, in terms of sea level rise?
When you go to a meter and a half, you're going to affect more acreage of the state. I think it's 11,000 acres is what they're looking at. So it's going to, first of all, it's going to impact a larger proportion of the population. But really, what it would do is it would cause them to look at all of the planning, planning of any activity within, you know, within that area that's a meter and a half, and, you know, and have to reconsider what they're going to do, you know, in terms of development, in terms of improvements. It's pretty wide open.
Now, someone from the Home Builders Association described this proposal as stigmatizing the coastal areas. But the coastal areas are going to be affected no matter whether it's your numbers or somebody else's.
It will. And it will stigmatize the area. You know, you have to look at, you know, right now the state, you know, it what it's going to do is it's going to have a detrimental impact on the economy, on the state's economy. And it will impact the tourist area, the beach areas. I mean, the state development, Delaware Economic Development Office, you know, they promote Delaware for tourism and for businesses, but you know, the tourists come to the beaches. And, you know, if there's this potential that it's going to be there, I mean, I think you're going to scare people away.
So what happens if the worst-case scenario is right? I mean, how does your process allow us to deal with that?
Well, if we – yeah, that's a good question, Don. You know, we're saying today start it at a half a meter and half a meter and plan for that accordingly today, but the state should continue to monitor the sea level rise. So if, let's take, for example, in 15 years they take measurements and it's already at a half a meter, then they have to, you know, reevaluate. Or they may, you know, based on future knowledge, you know, based on future analysis, they would react accordingly. So we're not saying that it won't eventually get there. We just don't know. We just don't see that all the science is there yet to say that it shall be a meter and a half.
Howard Fortunato, the Executive Vice President of the Home Builders Association of Delaware. We now want to turn to John Mateko. He's chair of the Delaware chapter of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. He lives in Lewis and is also an architect. Welcome to the program, John. And I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, I know you see this as a bit of more of a broader issue than just simply sea level rise, that there's climate change, storm surge, and so on. Let's sort of flesh that out first. What's your sense about the importance of this report and how it relates to those larger issues?
Well, Don, thanks for this important discussion. I have to tell you, there's a personal interest in this issue because, as you may know, that my house and office is on the Lewis Harbor. So when last year, when Hurricane Sandy was predicted to make impact, and up until the last minute it was predicted to impact Lewis, I could look out the window and see the water rising. And that sort of concentrates your mind and you get away from, you know, the sort of the politics of this or anything else. You look at the real reality of what's happening and how much risk is prudent for public policymakers to be suggesting that communities should take. Now, to get to your point about how we look at this issue, I wish that the only problem we faced was sea level rise. But we will never face sea level rise in isolation. Sea level rise is one leg of a three-legged stool, the three main legs, I should say. There's some other minor legs. You see the minor legs if you're a forester or a farmer, the impacts on agriculture or forests and so forth. But for most people who reside in suburban or urban areas, we're going to see the impacts of climate change, or as it's better known, climate disruption, as three legs of a common stool. Sea level rise is the first. And that's, just as it sounds, a steady increase in the level of the sea level. The Bethany sea level gauge and the one here in Lewis has shown a steady rise. At Bethany, over the last 14 years, it's been about half a foot. So that's very concerning to that low-lying community. So that's just a fact. The first thing to talk about here is that has nothing to do with science. It's simply going and looking at the gauge. This is just a fact. So you don't need scientific theories or any excuse that, well, the science is this way or that way or not enough. Well, that you're just looking at the facts. So we have the sea level rising. The accompanying that, though, is going to be increasing intensity of coastal storms like Hurricane Sandy. They bring high winds and storm surge. The storm surge sits on top of this increased sea level. So you have to add to sea level rise, which is predicted to be somewhere between 1.6 feet and just shy of 5 feet by 2100. And that's the prediction right now. So on top of that, you would add the storm surge. Now, our friends from FEMA have found out that the storm surge in parts of New Jersey was as much as 15 feet. So you can see, if you just focus on 1.5 or 3 feet of the sea level rise, that's the minor part of the problem. But you have to look at the storm surge coming in on top of that and plan for both of them. The third element of this three-legged stool of climate change or climate disruption is summertime extreme heat events. The eminent climatologist Kathleen Hayhoe has just issued a draft report. It's in the hands of the Delaware state officials. It's due to be released in a week or so, or a few weeks. It has already been reported in the newspapers that she finds that over the next century we look forward to at least 65 days of temperatures 95 degrees Fahrenheit or above. It's the extreme heat events that are most likely, historically speaking, that's going to cause human fatalities. The first two events, sea level rise and storm surge, are the two legs of the awful chair that we're on that's going to cause massive property damage and, of course, some loss of life.
John, let me ask you this, because one of the issues is how much, obviously, the sea level will rise. Because, for instance, as you talk about, depending upon what the rise is there, will certainly then push up things like, for instance, the storm surge, was one of the things we explored, I think it was last year. And the argument, I guess, from the home builders was the idea that we have a range and we want to be at least careful about not over-projecting. And they've actually suggested some kind of sort of rolling review of the of just how high this thing might go up. What's wrong with that more flexible idea of saying, okay, well, it'll rise this much, and then we'll take a look, and if it's rising some more, then we'll, you know, deal with that. What about that?
Well, let's be clear. The science is constantly ongoing, and you always want to be evaluating what techniques are working and what not. So that's just a given. But the fact is there are sections here in Lewis, for instance, on Lewis Beach, which flood routinely with severe weather conditions. The main road to Lewis Beach, Savannah Road, is always flooded with a couple of feet, 2 or 3 feet already. Now, public officials have to make a decision. Should additional development in the private sector be going in areas which are going to be not sustainable in the future? And should public tax dollars be going to just put Band-Aids on public infrastructure, multi-million dollar roads and bridges and so forth? What's the prudent approach? And it may be easy to talk about it like when, you know, you want to talk policy stuff like that. Everybody likes talking like that, have opinion. But if it was your own property and you had to manage it, would you say, you know what, the cards are there, we can see them. Let's just pull back and have a policy. Instead of throwing money down a sinkhole, let's use that money and offer that, for instance, as in some states, sections of Virginia, cities there, they are already purchasing land inland of the city as retreat lots so that the people closest, residents with homes closest to the seacoast, they get first dibs. They can retreat, relocate back inland. They're still in the city. They still have their neighbors. They're still out of the same church. The kids go to the same school, the doctors. It is not a massive disruption of their life, but they are taken out of harm's way. Now, some folks want to do that, and some people don't, and that's at this point still an option for them. But that's maybe something that has to be talked about as a public policy issue. What's the prudent way to make limited public funds available for this problem.
We've been speaking with John Matego. He's chair of the Delaware chapter, the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, also a resident of Lewis and an architect. And John, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you. It will be 50 years this month since the 1963 March on Washington, which drew more than 250,000 people to the mall in the nation's capital. There was some skepticism from the Kennedy White House about the effectiveness of the event. Others expressed concern for potential violence. But as the events unfold, it propelled Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. into the national spotlight with his I Have a Dream speech. And the subsequent 2 years saw the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So we want to take a look back at that moment and assess certainly where we are. And we have George Wally. He actually attended the march when he was about 23 years old, and I guess you were also in the military. And he's also retired now at this point. So describe for me your decision. You were in the military, which is sort of interesting, and you decided to go ahead and attend the march. What was the atmosphere like when all this was going on? Because we tend to forget, you know, what that was like.
First of all, I was in the military, but as a first lieutenant, I was working in an office that was primarily civilians. And so I put my suit and tie on and went into the office at 7:30 in the morning and worked from 7:30 to 8:30. And then at 8:30, I told the people in the office that I was leaving for the march, which was going to happen that afternoon. And now some of the people in the office were concerned about my safety, and because I would say a large percentage of the people in the office were convinced that major violence was going to erupt because there'd never been a large nonviolent march, and there'd never been large marches of any kind. In fact, very large marches in the early 60s were just either rare to non-existent. And so so they were concerned. But, you know, that was one of these things that I said, I'm going to have to take part in this. So off I went.
Well, were they sympathetic towards the march or towards its aspirations? What was the feelings there?
Well, first of all, most of them, because like I mentioned, I was the only African-American officer in the office. There were a few other officers in the office, but they, like everybody else, just felt that the march and the potential violence wasn't necessary. Now, in terms of what was necessary to cause the nation to move forward was a different issue. But they just felt that the march and the potential for violence just wasn't necessary.
So when you left the office, where did you go? What was the trip like?
The interesting thing is that my office was in Arlington, Virginia. And so I drove to the backside of the National Cemetery at Arlington, and then you could park on the backside of the cemetery. So I parked on the backside of Arlington Cemetery, walked to the Memorial Bridge, and then once you get to the Memorial Bridge, the Lincoln Memorial is right in front of you. And so I just walked around to the front side of the memorial, and on the left side of the bridge, I got under a tree so that I was in the shade, and spent the rest of the day there with thousands and thousands of people. I mean, you know, imagine, because I'm probably 150 yards from the front of the memorial. And as far as I could see in any direction, it was just people, people, people.
So what was the mood like? I had a figure here that I ran across in which I guess it was something like the composition of the crowd, which was about over 250,000, something from 250,000 to 300,000, that one of the estimates was that 75% of the people who attended were what were described as people of color, but then so the other 25% were folks who were white at the time. So what was that mood like? What was it, optimistic? I mean, what? What were people doing?
I think everybody else that I talked to who were around me just sort of had the same impression that I had. First, I wanted to do my part, and they said, you know, they wanted to do their part. And of course, some of the people around me had traveled by bus all night. And, you know, and they told me about their experiences in trying to get there, because mine were easy, but but they, you know, they shared those experiences in trying to get there. And the other thing is there were a large number of marshals spread throughout the audience to make sure that everything went as it was supposed to. And that was both surprising and comforting. And then now realize that, you know, we arrived in the morning. The speeches started early in the day.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because Martin Luther King's speech was the final. So we sit and listen. This was before the days of Bowerwater.
That's right, exactly. That's, or Twitter or anything else. That's right. That's right. Well, but then we talked about the folks who would come by bus and so. What kinds of problem did they encounter? What was that trip like for them? Did they describe what that trip was like then?
Yes, but you know, in the 60s. Traveling all night by bus was not something that was rare. I mean, you know, I grew up in Houston, and at the time I was working in Washington, D.C., and either by car or by bus was by far the most efficient way to get from one place to the other. And if you did it, the bus drove all night and you stayed awake all night. So it wasn't
unusual.
It wasn't unusual, yeah, to travel by bus and to stay awake on the bus.
Mm-hmm. So you lived obviously in the area in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. in 1960 was still a segregated town. The Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act were still a year or two away. What was Washington, D.C. like during that period?
Well, let me just I think the best way I could describe it is that Washington, D.C., I didn't experience a lot of problems. Didn't experience as much problems in the district as I did in the areas around it.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, for example, I remember going out playing some golf with some guys that I work with, and then afterwards they said, let's go to this restaurant and get a sandwich. And it turned out that they were welcome, but I wasn't. But you know that happened. But we just went two doors down, and in D.C. we had no problem. The problem was that I was working in Arlington, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and the areas around the district were. Frankly, as bad as they were in Alabama. I knew what restaurants I could go into and which ones I couldn't. It was interesting in that people that I worked with didn't know which restaurants I could go into and which ones I couldn't. And, you know, we would go out. I played on the basketball team at Arlington Hall Station, and we played a game one night, and then we said, well, let's go get a sandwich. And the team fouled its way into a local restaurant, and I fouled my way right in with them, mm-hmm. and I guess there were probably seven or eight of them in front of me and seven or eight of them behind. And they all sit down, and they were ready to eat. And they said, well, if he's going to eat with you, you got to leave.
Oh, my gosh. How do they react today? Friends?
The team members were, you know, they said, if that's the case, we got to leave. And so all my teammates got up and left, and we went to one of the eating places on the military base, because we knew that on the military base we could, you know, we could do what we wanted to. But that happened.
Yes,
that happened to me, you know, several times.
Let me ask you about President Kennedy, because he has become an icon certainly over the years. And he made the phone call when he was campaigning to Martin Luther King when he was in jail. And yet Kennedy's record on civil rights was not exactly exemplary. I mean, in the Senate, I guess, he criticized Brown versus Board of Education, which desegregated the schools. He voted, I think, about 1957 civil rights. And so, but yet he made this phone call, and he looked as an icon in many ways.
For me personally.
Yeah.
Kennedy was a breath of fresh air. And compared to his competitors, there was no question that he was a breath of fresh air. I'm convinced that his call was genuine. And I'm convinced that all of his comments were genuine. Now, part of that, you know, was the fact that the part of Boston that he grew up in was a lot more accommodating than either the Washington, D.C. area or to the areas of the South further on. And so, and 'cause I had, you know, a little bit later in my career, I had a chance to go up and spend some time in Boston, and I got a chance to actually see that firsthand. I could tell then that he was a breath of fresh air.
Now, on the other hand, we had some folks who didn't like the March on Washington. Malcolm X, I think, called it the farce in Washington. I think it was someone from SNCC decided he didn't want to go. I mean, what did you make of all of that? I mean, or were those minor voices in your mind?
By that time, I could predict that Malcolm X wouldn't support the march before it was even proposed.
Yeah.
Because of his way of doing business. I knew what to expect from Malcolm X. I knew what to expect from Martin Luther King. I knew what to expect from, you know, from myself.
Now, were you able to hear clearly King's speech? And B, were you aware how significant it might be?
Well, first of all, yes, because, like I mentioned, because I was less than 100 yards from from the Lincoln Memorial. In other words, as the reflection pool comes up, I was beyond the front edge of the reflection pool, and to the side of the Lincoln Memorial. And from where I was, I could see it very clearly. Now, the interesting thing is that one of King's idols was Benjamin Mays, Dr. Benjamin Mays, who was president of one of the African-American right. University. And I had heard Benjamin Mays speak at a commencement address.
Mm-hmm.
And when in preparing for it, I said, if he's anything like Benjamin Mays, this is going to be worth hearing.
And it was, I guess.
And it was surprising that he's probably just a little bit better.
In the last 30 seconds we have, so what were your feelings? I think we're now 50 years later. Understand the president is going to actually make a speech in the very same spot. What's your own feelings at this point? I mean, we come a long way?
That's all history now. So we've come long ways. And... and so that's really it. And what problems we have that remain. I put them in the basket with a lot of other kind of problems that we have. So I can assure you that as in the years to come, you know, there are going to be other problems.
We'll deal with them, yeah. We would speak with George Woolley. He was 23 years old and attended the March on Washington in 1963. And appreciate you to sharing some of your memories with us.
Okay.
Thank you. Again, it's George Woolley. He attended the march, and this has been Del Mar Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Del Mar Today is a production of Del Mar Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC14.org for full details and schedules.